national NBA writer for Bleacher Report, Howard Beck. Howard, how you doing today?
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Doing well, Howard.
Good, Howard.
Doing well. Howard, let me ask you, Jonesy and I just spent the first 10 minutes or so here talking about, again, the NBA. We're essentially a month away from the first game, July 30th, the Raptors playing on August 1st. At this point, just as of today, before camps have even opened, Howard, how comfortable are you with what the NBA has put in place, the plan, and how effective, ultimately, you think it can or will be?
Well, I will say it's probably not relevant whether I'm comfortable with it. I mean, the most important thing is that, you know, the 300 some odd players who are going are comfortable with it, that the staffs who are going are comfortable with it, that all the other personnel, the referees. And on top of that, you know, I'll leave it to the epidemiologists. And, you know, most of the reporting in the wake of the NBA unveiling its plans has had epidemiologists generally giving them good marks, saying, you know what, there's no perfect plan. There's no plan that's risk-free. But this is solid. They've done a good job. This has a reasonable chance of working. All that said, you know, my perspective, for what it's worth, it doesn't look great when cases are spiking as badly as they are around Florida, and in particular in Orange County, Florida, where the NBA is going to be setting up camp for a few months. And I wonder how much worse it might get. I also wonder, as I asked Adam Silver on the conference call on Friday, you know, and it's not a question he could answer, but I had to ask, you know, would you go there if you knew it was going to be this bad? And is there a threshold beyond which you should not be there? How bad do the cases have to spike? How bad does the spread have to be before the NBA decides that maybe this is not worth the risk? Now, I think this train is just moving. I don't think you're stopping it at this point. I think they're going regardless. I think this is happening regardless. But at some point, the optics and or the logistics could become untenable. That seems like that's within the realm of possibility. But you hope for the best at this point.
Howard, how bad does it look if they have to shut it down again?
Obviously terrible if they have to shut it down again, but not as bad as it would look for someone to get terribly ill or die, you know, as a result of this. And it's not just NBA personnel. There's all the Disney staff who are going to have to be servicing them. I don't know, you know, what the numbers are of how many Disney staffers are going to be cycling in and out of there over the course of weeks and months. But those people are all at risk just going to work. And obviously they're introducing some risk into this non-bubble bubble. So I think there's risk no matter what they do. They're trying to minimize it. They've done, by all accounts, a very good job of planning for this. But we're in just such uncharted territory here on every single level that you can't anticipate everything, and you can't predict how this is going to unfold. And if they had to shut down again, it means something went really badly, and that thing is worse than having to stop play.
Speaking with Howard Beck from Bleacher Report. Howard, kind of further to that point, and I believe Adam Silver has already addressed this, but it's still kind of one of those what-if scenarios that continues to be thrown out there. There can't be or won't be any special rules for any certain players, i.e., knock on wood, we pray this doesn't happen, obviously. If one of the superstars of the league, if a LeBron James were to test positive and have to go into quarantine for 14 days on the eve of a conference finals, an NBA finals, or whatever, the Lakers just have to forge forward without him, correct? There's not going to be any special consideration given to certain players or certain teams.
No, this is not a time for people and their conspiracy theories and their unbridled cynicism. The NBA is obligated for all kinds of reasons, moral, ethical, health, to apply the same standard to every player. So if someone's positive for the virus, they're positive for the virus. And if testing positive means quarantine and missing a week of games or more, then that's what it means. And there's no way around that. You can't possibly risk people's lives and their health to get cute with something like that. So I know people always have their suspicions and think that you know, whether if it's LeBron or Giannis or somebody, that the rules don't apply. Like, this is not a time to be thinking that way, folks. Like, it just the NBA could not possibly afford to do that. Now, if it comes to people leaving the bubble and wandering out into Orlando because they're you know, sick of being cooped up, and you want to say that maybe the league would turn a blind eye when it's some players rather than others? Maybe. I don't know. I mean, that's going to be a real test of a lot of things here. Everyone's own self-discipline when it comes to staying in the bubble, the league's pseudo-policing of it. How are they going to determine whether somebody left? And because if they do, then when they come back, they're supposed to be quarantined. And the temptation to leave is going to be pretty high, I would think, and more so after the longer you've been there, because it's going to be tough just to be cooped up on that campus with very, you know, little contact with anybody.
Howard, you're, as I like to say, you're of a certain vintage that you would remember the NBA in days when the names on the back of uniforms weren't always surnames, as I think it was mandated by David Stern in the late 70s, early 80s, where, you know, Archie Clark had Archie on the back and Pete Maravich had Pistol on the back. And in the unique nature of this restart, players may be allowed to put social justice messages or, you know, honor people in that sense or the cause, the movement. What do you think we might see?
I don't know. I'll be curious to see how many guys avail themselves of that option, if that truly comes to pass. I think it's a potentially powerful bit of symbolism to represent somebody else, whether it's Breonna Taylor or George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Trayvon Martin, whoever. I mean, you could, like, the list of names is depressingly long when you start to see these, you know, the lists that have come out recently, just kind of compiling the last 5-10 years worth of killings of unarmed black men and women. And if they wanted to, if the players wanted to make it a tribute to everyone whose names are now part of this larger cause, that's one powerful gesture. You know, nothing is going to be as powerful as the other things that the league can do in terms of the players and teams engaging with organizations and donating their time and their money. There'll be all, you know, the gestures can take on all different forms, and I assume we'll see a bit of all of that in Orlando.
Howard, why do you think over the years, and I mean, we can go back to David Stern, but certainly during Adam Silver's reign as well, why do you think that the NBA has been as open, accepting, progressive in terms of its backing and sort of companionship, allyship alongside the players to allow them to continue to have their voice, as opposed to what we've maybe seen in other sports where whether it be executives or league office commissioner themselves seem to kind of mute or try to control the message from the players much more than what the NBA does, where the NBA seems much more open to giving players and allowing players to have their platform?
Yeah, I don't know enough about the other leagues to be able to compare and contrast accurately. I've never covered, you know, Major League Baseball. I've never covered the NFL or NHL. It's sometimes hard to do this from a distance. We can only guess. But, I mean, look, football's always been very top-down and kind of authoritarian, frankly, in the way that they've run that league. And I just think that, you know, say you compare baseball to the NBA, if you consider that a lot of the activism, especially the current activism, has to do with issues that are of major concern to African Americans, and when you consider that the NBA is at any given time, any given year, 75-80% black, it's natural that there's going to be a much bigger desire, broadly speaking, across all teams and players to want to do something and speak out at a time like this, especially than in, say, baseball, where there's you know, I don't even know what the percentage of black players is anymore, but it's shrunk over the decades.
About 8, Howard.
Yeah.
So, about 8%, yeah.
Yeah, and that's way down from where it was, you know, when we were all growing up. So I think some of this is demographics. I think some of this is just the way that these leagues have evolved in terms of the culture of the league, the relationship. You know, it's funny. People think about David Stern as having been, you know, kind of authoritarian himself, and there were moments when he was. He was certainly the disciplinarian, and he certainly would come with a hammer when it came time to negotiations for the collective bargaining agreement, but that was his job. What people often overlook is that David Stern was also a very progressive individual personally, to say nothing of you know, what he had to do as a businessman representing the owners. But the way he always framed it, the way that the league always framed it, was that during times of labor peace, this is a partnership. And even actually during labor negotiations, it was a partnership. When you think about the whole fundamental of their split of revenues is about splitting basketball-related income, BRI. And at one time, that went up over 57%, and then ratcheted it down to closer to 50-51 for the players. But it's a partnership. It's half the revenue to the owners, half the players. And they have generally viewed it that way. They talk about it that way. And so I think it's just an outgrowth of that the league is more supportive of players in other endeavors, whereas I don't think the other leagues view it that way.
Hey, Howard, give me your list of probably the top five or six teams you would think that would have the best chances of winning. Are there any surprises in there other than the people we look at as chalk, like, you know, Toronto, Milwaukee, Boston in the East, and then, you know, the Lakers, the Clippers, and, you know, throw a blanket over a few in the West. But do you think there are any surprises in there, or do you think we're going to see a finals coming from that group?
I'm going to give you two different answers, and I'm not sure which one's right. The first answer is the one that's based on where the season left off in March, which is that the Lakers and Clippers were, I think, the only true contenders in the West. There are some other good teams, but I just don't think that it was reasonable, at least as of March 11th, to think that anybody else was going to come out of the West other than the Lakers or Clippers. And in the East, as much as Milwaukee had this big lead on everybody in terms of record, I never was convinced that they were far and away better than that next tier. I thought that they were the favorites, but not runaway favorites. And I thought Boston and Toronto were the two most likely to be able to knock them off. And I wouldn't rule out, if they got right, you know, on a roll at the right time, Miami and Philadelphia are I think legitimate potential contenders. So there's the theoretical list, but that was as of March 11th. As we sit here on June 29th, who the heck knows? I mean, these teams have been off for months. These teams have been off for months. We don't know what kind of shape any individual is in. We don't know what kind of rhythm these teams will have when they come back with a short training camp and then jumping into a bunch of what I would consider basically glorified exhibitions. Like, yeah, they're going to count in the standings, and yeah, they're going to have something to do with the seeding. But those eight games, especially against teams like Washington and Phoenix and Sacramento that have no shot at the playoffs and very little motivation and probably won't play their starters after the first couple of games or may not play their frontline players. Who knows? Basketball is going to be pretty lousy for those eight seeding games, I think. But it's going to give the contenders or the hopeful contenders a chance to get back in rhythm. Can they get back in rhythm that quickly to the point where they're playing at a postseason type level when it's time for the playoffs to begin? I don't know. So that answer leads to this. It may be much more wide open than we would have thought on March 11th, because the teams that have the talent advantage, Lakers, Clippers, Bucks, might not have as much of an advantage once everyone's been off for months and people are just trying to just get their rhythm back.
Speaking to Howard Beck from Bleacher Report, Howard, I acknowledge in asking this, yet again, it will probably be a question where there is no definitive answer, and the best answer might be, who knows, because we really don't know. But I'm going to ask it anyways. Earlier today, on a Zoom call, a conference call, Masai Ujiri said, acknowledging his optimism and his positivity, he said that, God willing, he believes next year the NBA is playing in front of fans. The NBA is now talking about whether it's a December 1st or a December 25th start date. If we look beyond this end to the 2019-2020 season, as we sit here now on June 29th, can we even possibly think about what the 2020-2021 season might look like in terms of when it starts? Are there fans? Are teams hopscotching all over North America as regular? How does next season look as we sit here in the middle of 2020?
Yeah, obviously impossible to answer. On my podcast later this afternoon, I'm taping with a couple of epidemiologists who I've had on once before, and I'm going to throw that question at them, and they will probably have a little bit more to say than I can because they're experts and I'm not. But my guess is that their answer will be much the same, which is, who knows where we will be as a society in December or January. And look, Dr. Fauci has said recently that he thinks that a vaccine could be here by the end of the year or in January, but having a vaccine and having it mass produced and mass distributed are two different things. And I think that you need the vaccine is a prerequisite to having fans back in buildings, or at least full buildings. And so I think next season starts without fans. I'm curious to whether or not next season starts in home markets or not, because now you're introducing travel back into the equation. It's no longer a bubble. Like, are we far enough along in December that we can have teams playing in their home markets again and traveling? I think that's even a question before we even get to whether or not fans can be in the building.
Well, you know, Howard, it just hit me there. We used to always bump into each other in New York and either in Brooklyn or MSG and have a chance to sit down and chat about everything. And then we'd take, a 10-minute segment like this and put it on the air. And it just makes you wonder when the heck are we getting back to anything that resembles close to what we used to before? And if we don't, how does that change the landscape going forward for never mind all of us in the media? I mean, as Eric said, we did a 42-person Zoom call today with Masai Ujiri and Fred VanVleet. What happens to the people that work in these arenas and the parking lots that depend on these jobs? Like, what does that do to the economy? I mean, it's crazy.
I know. And that's just our little piece of the world, right? Like, that's right. Our little bubbles. We see, we see the ticket takers and the ushers and parking lot attendants and locker room attendants. And all of a sudden you think about how many people are affected and then, expand out. And of course, people working in restaurants and bars and everything else. It's just tough for everybody. And I wish we could all be back in those arenas, schmoozing before game time and chit-chatting with scouts and GMs and each other and all that. That feels like it's a long ways in our rearview mirror already, and it feels like it could be a long way off in our future too. Look, obviously we're going to get through this. At some point there will be a vaccine, and at some point we will all be able to resume some sense of normalcy. But the worst thing possible is for people to start rushing back before we can actually do this safely. And we've already seen that all over this country, where cases are spiking because they reopened economies too quickly. And people, part of this is just human nature. Oh, okay, the lockdown's over. Great. We're back to normal. But, and no social distancing and no wearing masks and people just acting like idiots and just being ignorant of how dangerous this thing still is and how prominent it still is. And so, I'm trying not to get too far ahead of myself when it comes to resuming whatever is normal for the NBA, because we have so many other steps we have to take before we even get to that, just as a society.